Welcome to the iCoder podcast with Ian McDuff.
Okay, hello once again, podcast and ODR audience, and welcome to this iCoder podcast after a bit of a delay between podcasts. I'm Ian McDuff, your host for the series, and speaking with you as always from Wellington in Aotearoa, New Zealand. In this conversation, I'm delighted to be joined by fellow New Zealander, Matt Bartlett, who's now based in New York. I first encountered Matt probably 2 years ago, I would think, two, maybe a bit more, while we were both in Auckland. Matt, having then completed his undergraduate degrees at Auckland University, I was then in my adjunct role as the director of the Centre for ICT Law. Matt and I found kind of common cause and issues relating to the emerging agendas in law and technology, and at that stage, particularly on the agenda for law schools and young lawyers who are facing technology. And I was thinking about that earlier, Matt, and thinking that you're very much the kind of technology native in that you've always had that around. Most of us on who are part of this having to kind of retrofit ourselves adjust to this new world. Matt is now a doctoral student at Columbia Law School, having completed a master's there, where his research focuses on the regulation of emerging technologies, particularly AI, hot button topic. And taught technology law and policy at the University of Auckland, and writes about technology issues at Technocracy. I need to get a web link from you for Technocracy, or I can look it up. Now, Matt warns me, or seeks to assure me, that he's not an ODR person. I don't believe that. but in the same vein as many of the previous guests on these podcasts, but I know, Matt, that you're a very articulate and well-informed commentator on the intersection of law, policy, and digital technologies. So, Matt, thank you for taking time out from your now very new start on your doctoral studies, about which I'd like to ask you a few questions. And Matt, you and I will probably, as fellow New Zealanders, need to do our very best not to lapse into the kind of jargon or easy familiarity that a couple of Kiwis together can do, so that those who don't have the benefit of simultaneous translation or subtitles can actually understand what we're on about. So welcome to the podcast series, Matt. Good to see you.
Thank you. Thank you for that kind introduction. I'm excited to chat.
Great. We've got four or five topics, and you've given me a little bit heads up on those, but you're just embarking on your doctoral mission. consider this the kind of 3-minute elevator pitch. What are you going to be working on?
Sure. So my high-level pitch is looking at regulating emerging technologies, but specifically how the US and the European Union have separately taken different approaches to emerging technologies in the past, and what that means for AI. And like you say, it's a hot button issue. It's probably, at least in my view, the most important technology in the world. It projects to become only more important over the next decade, let alone decades after that. Mm-hmm. And it's, at least to me, really, really important what lawmakers, what regulators, and what politicians do when it comes to creating frameworks around AI development, AI use, AI ethics, all these kinds of principles that go into the legal nexus, if you like, or the series of rules and principles and norms that then govern AI as a technology. And so what my dissertation or my thesis will do is compare different jurisdictional treatments of emerging technologies to date, and then look at what that means legally, pragmatically, but also philosophically for regulating AI, which is the most kind of pressing emerging technology today. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a high level take.
Could you, I think we're probably on the same page here, but for the sake of everyone out there, emerging technologies, I mean, there are a whole lot of technologies. We can talk about CRISPR gene technology, you're specifically dealing with the digital technologies as they impact on law and regulation. That's your
favorite. That's correct. Yeah, okay. That's right. So digital technologies. I'm sure we'll talk about social media in this chat, because the truth is a lot of the social media or digital platforms that are so prevalent, so powerful, arguably so monopolistic today, they have AI at their heart. And so when I think about AI as a problem, or as a not a problem as much as a set of issues or a set of challenges, I'm often thinking about things we would normally think as kind of social media type challenges or social media type roles. And I'm happy to give a more specific example if you want. But that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah. I mean, your path may well cross with that of our former Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, who, she's at Harvard at the moment.
Harvard.
And dealing with the ongoing issues of the Christchurch call and the regulation of that side of digital technologies, the social media side of it. And there's an issue which we may come back to too. I recall having to deal with this back in the dark ages when I was teaching ethics and law in Singapore, which is the challenge of regulation as to whether those who typically regulate know enough about the subject which they're regulating, and the temptation is to leave it to those who are being regulated to regulate themselves. And I don't know, how do you plan to address that in your thesis?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Because then those who are being regulated would typically regard themselves as the best in the position to regulate. In the same way, the fishing industry here would regard itself as the best body to regulate whether or not bottom trawling should be continued.
Right.
Yeah. And bottom trawling is probably not a good analogy for AI and digital technology.
it
might be for social media.
It might be.
Yeah. I mean, as you were giving that pitch, though, Matt, it occurred to me one of your challenges is going to be updating yourself, because by the time you get to the end of 3 years or thereabouts, the stuff you've written in year one will seem terribly passé because things change so rapidly. It's almost as though you need a sort of constant rolling update, and a loose leaf version of your thesis as you keep on putting new pages in.
Yeah, I'm afraid you're right. I'm psychologically preparing for that fact, for at least parts of my research to quickly be overtaken by developments. But I guess I would say what I'm aiming to do, what I'd like to produce in my research, I'd like to produce research that can stand the test of time at least a little bit, because I don't intend on doing a 100,000 word review of the EU AI Act, for instance. And so rather than focusing, even with AI itself, rather than just focusing on, say, like a specific model like ChatGPT, or like a new fancy model, which might be not fancy, it might be obsolete in even 3 years' time, my aim is to, I guess, take stock of the more structural forces that act on regulators and lawmakers as they look to build laws and rules into the future. So rather than go too granular, too specific on any one challenge, because that lends itself to, as you say, kind of pinning your mast or pinning your flag, or whatever the saying is, to a particular thing that might be out of date in a very short space of time. I guess what I'm trying to do with my research is take a step back and understand the different kind of quite long-term perspectives that in America and Europe, you've already got, you can get a sense of this from how those jurisdictions regulate many, many things. I'm sure we could talk about how, you know, the Americans tend to be a lot more comfortable with not putting rules in place. They've got a constitution, the First Amendment, that in fact stops them from putting particularly specific rules in place, for instance, on how social media can moderate content. And in Europe, you don't have the same set of obstacles, but you also have a different philosophical willingness to engage with some of the issues that are presented by technologies. And so one of the things I'll be doing is trying to take stock of those more long-term approaches, because I don't see those changing. I don't see the Americans changing their constitution in a hurry. And I also don't see the Europeans changing their approach, which is to more proactively engage, for better and for worse, with these sets of issues.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, you've got issues at either end, haven't you? Let me try and explain what I'm thinking here. One is, seems to be your work is heading towards the general principles of regulation rather than the granular approach, because that will at least survive the 3 years you're at Columbia. and the other is the looking at the impact. And if I think of in more micro terms of the impact of things like ChatGPT on universities.
Right. Yes.
On the one hand, it's the technology itself, what it does, and the other is the impact on student originality and plagiarism and the problem of regulating that. So it's, you're navigating that middle ground between the sort of general principles, which almost may be too big to deal with the granular issues, and the granular issues,
right,
which are too specific to be dealt with by principles. So you've got a wonderful challenge for the next few years. Yeah. And
it's quite, it's interesting. Maybe I can give a specific example, and maybe people less familiar or people who are super interested, that would be helpful.
Yep.
So I said before, I wasn't going to do 100,000 words on the AI Act, but I have recently done 15,000 words on the AI Act, and specifically, the question of generative AI. Yep. And so we're talking about ChatGPT, and it's kin. I'm sure most people listening will be familiar with this new kind of AI that relies on large language models and transformer technology at the back end. And as I kind of talk about in this paper I have in mind, it is fundamentally different. At the very least, the application that we can interact with as users is fundamentally different to the vast majority of algorithms and AI systems that kind of exist in the world, in the sense that ChatGPT and its technological kin can do many different things. They are very flexible, and they can code. They can give you answers to reasonably complicated legal questions sometimes, although we can come back to why you wouldn't want to come back to where you wouldn't want to ask it too many legal questions at this point. It can get creative. ChatGPT can write stories. Those stories are, you know, they seem to show a sense of originality and creative spark that I think a lot of people wouldn't normally associate with what AI can produce.
Mm-hmm.
And so ChatGPT is good at all these various things. And the reason that's a problem in the context of the AI Act in the European Union, but also more generally for how we've thought about regulating AI to date, is that a lot of the regulation is based on assessing the risk of the AI system's use case. So, for instance, the AI Act says if you have an AI that you're using in the criminal justice space, because maybe you're trying to estimate recidivism risk, like an example of Compass and other kind of similar systems that are used in the States, or even like you can think of a more kind of basic example, like your like Spotify playlist and it recommends songs to you, like then that's an AI that's used in the entertainment or the creative arts space. And then depending on what space that AI or that algorithm was designed for, the AI Act says it's either a high risk algorithm, and then it incurs a series of obligations, oversight requirements, transparency requirements, and so forth, or it's in a low risk domain, and then it essentially incurs no additional regulatory or bureaucratic issues. And that's designed so that if an AI has societal importance in some way or presents risk to fundamental rights in the European case, then the authorities that be are in a position to exert more power or more control over how that AI works and what it does, basically. And they don't need to do that for the majority of AI that isn't used in a sensitive context. And so that system sits at the heart of the EU's AI Act. It's a risk-based system where it it sorts obligations and assigns regulatory scrutiny based on the use case of the AI system. That is how that legislative scheme works. And that's how a lot of AI regulations work. And so when you then have a system like ChatGPT that can do, it can be used in a criminal justice system. And I note that I think recently a Court of Appeal judge in the UK even was caught using ChatGPT or something like it to generate a judgment, which is a bit naughty. The point is it can be used in that context. But obviously, most people use ChatGPT for much more boring, much more mundane things. I've asked ChatGPT how I should spend 4 days in Rome. And ChatGPT did a great job of giving me, you know, a travel itinerary. Other people use it to produce bedtime stories for their kids. And so the problem is, as a regulator looking at the AI Act, how are you supposed to decide whether ChatGPT is a high-risk system when it is capable of being used in high-risk use cases, but the vast majority of uses are not high-risk? And so that's what my research looked at was, okay, we've got a specific problem with ChatGPT, but then we've got this larger problem where the AI Act was drafted in 2021. And it was designed to be future-proof. It was designed so when AI technology evolves, then the framework will survive because it will just continue to kind of estimate the risk of that particular of any particular system and slot it into its categories. And so there's an immediate problem, which is it is unclear how the AI Act regulates generative AI. And the lawmakers kind of came back and threw in some last minute changes to specifically target generative AI. But the general point stands, which is it's not particularly clear. But then we have this larger issue, which is when the lawmakers drafted the AI Act, they had a particular conception of AI in mind. And because AI is the definition of an emergent technology that's continuing to develop sometimes in unexpected ways, and also at massive scale, right? Because ChatGPT has hundreds of, or at least 100 million users now. That presents some real challenges to lawmaking, particularly with the approach that the EU takes, which is often to assign regulatory scrutiny and to create obligations. And so we've got this bigger question here about how lawmakers can do that when the technology itself is liable to change quite radically in ways that the lawmakers don't expect.
Yeah, there's a challenge there too, isn't it? In that your point you just made about the 100 million users of ChatGPT is not just regulating the technology, but regulating the users of the technology. You know, if you take a dumb analogy, cars may be high risk or low risk technology,
right,
depending on who's driving them.
That's right. Yeah.
The basic regulation is regulating the safety of cars and regulating the drivers. But you know, God knows, I mean, I got my driving license when I was 16, which is a couple of years ago, and haven't been tested since. But how do you, on the model, the European model, the EU model, how, if we've got 100 million users of generative AI, how do you regulate the use of that? Because that means a level of scrutiny, doesn't it? Which is hard to envisage in a broad piece of legislation, I would imagine.
Yeah, you're completely right. And in fact, it's even more complicated than that, because some subset of those users are developers that take ChatGPT and use it as a foundation model or a foundational model where they tinker with it, they build other AI systems on top of it. And so then the liability is even further confused. This is called the AI value chain, because at what point does the original developer stop being responsible if that AI system malfunctions or does something bad? If the system has been taken by a downstream developer and built on or modified in some way, and then what happens when that happens again, and then someone else builds on that second generation? And because ChatGPT is so versatile, it's so flexible the underlying technology is really strong, it's really popular as a foundation model. There are lots of developers looking to embed this technology in other kinds of systems. And that poses huge challenges because, I mean, we're talking not just about users, but we're talking about users / developers that are taking that technology and amending it and tinkering with this and maybe not even understanding. And this is part of the problem, is that if I was a developer and I took ChatGPT and wanted to use it for my own whatever I want to do with it, then yeah. I might not understand. And I absolutely do not understand everything that went on with the training of that original model, because that's commercially sensitive. And so I can have a general sense of how ChatGPT is trained and how it was created, but I don't know everything. And I certainly don't know some of the intricacies which might then trip me later on when there might be some room for an exploit that I don't know about. So I might unintentionally undermine some of the safeguards that OpenAI, the developer of ChatGPT, have built into the system, because I don't fully understand the system as well as the original developer does. So it's not clear. The AI Act talks about like a substantial modification, but of course, because it's so new, because all of this is so new, we don't have a clear sense of what a substantial modification is. And so it's not very satisfactory for us lawyers who like to kind of have a clear sense of where liability, where responsibility sits. We don't have that with AI.
It does some scary things for the old principles of vicarious liability, doesn't it? I mean, goodness knows where that stands anymore. Is an original developer or the original developer of ChatGPT in some way vicariously liable? I mean, I doubt that that's been tested, and I probably doubt also whether those principles will work. The question, when you talk about OpenAI, which is the familiar name, that doesn't mean that the source code of ChatGPT is open, does it?
No, absolutely not. It's complicated because there are, and actually one specific thing that lawmakers have put into the AI Act now is a requirement for foundational models like ChatGPT, the developers of those models, to release more documentation to address that very problem that I was just talking about, where then downstream developers don't understand the model that they're tinkering with and building on. But you're right, it's very, even if you know the training data or have a sense of the training data, that's not enough. The training process is very complicated. It involves a lot of human interaction and human tinkering. We don't know exactly, we don't know many of the details of how exactly OpenAI created ChatGPT. And I would say, I think OpenAI are more transparent than, arguably they're more transparent than they legally have to be, but they're also more transparent than other companies. And so I think it would be unfair to hold OpenAI up and say that they're kind of a bastion of bad practice here, because I don't think that's the case. But it is true that source code, no source code, training data, no training data, there is an enormous amount of detail that it's unlikely will be legally required to be made public or made available, because that's the secret source. That's how they've made ChatGPT as good as it is. Sorry, the long-winded answer to your question, but it is complicated.
Yeah, on your point there, you know, make it as good as it is. I mean, there's been a recent exchange of emails around our ICOTA and National Center for Technology and Dispute Resolution Network, particularly coming from good friend and colleague Ben Davis, who is a very thoughtful chap on the risks. And in fact, what I might do is send some of that correspondence to you, because one of the concerns that Ben raises, I mean, he's retired from law teaching now, is kind of error coding. And it's come up in terms of judges who use ChatGPT, or counsel who do, and counsel who, I think in the US, counsel was spotted having used ChatGPT, which simply made stuff up.
Yes, yeah.
And I don't know where the liability comes from that. If you ask ChatGPT to write something for you, if it doesn't have the language model or the data set, it makes stuff up. I mean, yeah. And as a typical egotist, in early days of ChatGPT, I asked it to tell me about me. And it invented an enormous line of nonsense about apparently I was an author of a 19th century Scottish novel. And actually, the novel, which I allegedly wrote, does exist, but by an author with a name nothing like mine.
Right.
How do we deal with that kind of risk when you go back to the EU model of risk? Where the risk is not only impact, but the risk is of errors being encoded, where ChatGPT obviously and the version 4 of it is getting better, but it ain't perfect. Right. Errors are built in.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. I mean, this is to some extent a technological problem. You imagine how many times people at OpenAI have pulled their hair out because what you're talking about, this tendency of ChatGPT to hallucinate or make up information that doesn't exist, it really hampers the usefulness of the product, of the AI. And so, I really, like you kind of referenced, I expect this to be improved. I expect this to continue to get better as they find ways to try to find kind of technological means to double check and kind of almost introduce like a reality check or a common sense check. And I've seen some interesting ideas from different AI developers on how they could maybe build that into their existing systems. But maybe to a more general point, it is inevitable that at least for the foreseeable future, AI systems will make mistakes. And they will sometimes make mistakes, like ChatGPT does, in an incredibly persuasive way. When I was talking to a New Zealand newspaper about this, a journalist was interviewing me and asking me if I recommended that kind of people with legal questions ask ChatGPT. The truth is, ChatGPT is in no state to answer legal questions, not because it will get everything wrong, because that's not true. It does sometimes get things right. The problem is, if you're not a lawyer or if you're not an expert in whatever the space is, you're actually really poorly equipped to know, because ChatGPT doesn't give you confidence intervals. It's incredibly brash. It just says, this is the answer. And sometimes you can respond and say, but that's not true. I just checked and it doesn't exist. And they're like, and the system says, no, that's right. It doesn't exist. And the problem is, if you don't know to ask it that follow-up question, then you're stuck. So to this general problem, if you're in a position where you're relying on ChatGPT to give you content, like for instance, think about this in a hospital, like that could have really serious consequences if doctors or nurses or anyone, hospital administrators, were using ChatGPT maybe to automate some, I'm sure, mundane and lengthy paperwork. Yeah. Then the possibility that system makes a mistake could be really serious. And it's just not near the point where we could reliably say it won't make a mistake, and no sensible AI developer would say that it is. And so I'm not sure exactly how this fits into, for instance, what the EU would want to do. I know that because, for instance, a lot of the risk there is not something that AI companies are allowing. Like that is my kind of initial point, which is if they could, developers and companies like OpenAI would train their systems out of it in a heartbeat. So it's not the kind of thing where if you make a regulation saying no AI system can hallucinate, that will just bring about the desired change, because all the incentives align for technologists and developers to try to innovate in that direction anyway. On the other hand, the prospect of an AI that hallucinates at scale possibly could be one of the things where a lawmaker could create some rules around. It's a little bit hard to imagine how this practically shakes out, but you could imagine some rule around if it hallucinates too badly, or if it's too prone, for instance, to fraudulently like deceive consumers, then it could, oh sorry, users, then it could start to fall afoul of consumer protection law. And that's an angle that someone in the consumer protection angle is the source of a lawsuit against OpenAI in the States, because they are alleging that partly because the system is so prone to error, that's a breach of people's consumer rights. And so it's not clear how that will shake out under the regulator, the FTC, and in the States. But I think that is an example, kind of the AI's tendency to hallucinate could be a push for further regulation. Although, like I said, I don't know if it's the kind of thing a regulator can easily fix with regulation. So it's a bit of a delicate balance.
I'm just wondering, I mean, the consumer example is a good one, but an example that comes to mind as you were thinking about, I love the term hallucinate. I've not heard that with reference to GPT before, but it's with your permission, I shall now claim it. But I was thinking of the responsibility of those who use ChatGPT to present information. Just, well, a small domestic example. One of the jobs from home my wife does is writing commentary and employment law for Westlaw. And she's got a bundle of titles to deal with, one of which is the Fair Pay Act. Now, suppose that she, being overwhelmed with the amount of work, said, ask ChatGPT to provide a commentary on recent cases, or there aren't any on recent commentaries on fair pay, and ChatGPT made it up, and lawyers relied on Westlaw. Where does the liability sit? Is it an obligation on the front end user of ChatGPT to make sure that the product is a good one, or is there any liability on ChatGPT, who will probably throw up their hands in horror and say, you know, we're simply a platform? Is that something the regulators can deal with?
Well, I think OpenAI does the right thing right now, which is flag very openly and publicly that their system does have a tendency to hallucinate. What they would argue that users are using their product with an understanding of the limitations of the system.
Yeah.
And I think to some extent that is right. That seems right to me, because at the end of the day, it's an application that OpenAI isn't necessarily signing. I don't think it should be the case that OpenAI could be held responsible for everything that the system is then used to do. That would seem to open AI developers up to enormous liability. Nobody would develop any AI again. Yeah, that's right. And it doesn't quite seem, but that does seem a little bit too far away in terms of causation for me. So at least from my perspective, I don't think that those lawyers in your example should be able to take their claim to OpenAI. The first thing to say is, as lawyers, they should be not just relying on Westlaw, right? They should be double checking their sources and making sure for any submissions or filings that they get. We know they don't. That's right. I guess, look, this is a real question for not just Westlaw and kind of the legal world, but all journalism, all kinds of kind of information, any job or any workspace that's connected with content and information. This will be a problem that they'll have to navigate. It's specifically a problem in the law, because we do rely on facts, objective reality to some extent. You know, like, we rely on cases and laws that you can't, if you misconstrue the statute and you say that a statute means something else, then that's you're not doing your job as a lawyer, right? But our job is to engage with the law, statutes and case law kind of as it is. We can't just willy-nilly invent things and invent a new legal reality for ourselves. And so versus, for instance, in something like marketing, where maybe there's like a little bit more scope to be creative and recreate stuff, it's less important to be objectively true. Although, you know, you'd hope in marketing you're not too creative
about that.
That's true. Maybe that's a poor example. But I think in law, we are particularly exposed to the kinds of hallucinations where an AI gives us a thing that looks correct, but is actually wrong. And so, I mean, I think it's very clear now that lawyers cannot rely on ChatGPT. And I guess by extension, Westlaw should not be relying on ChatGPT. Westlaw knows it's providing a service, an information source to lawyers, as you say, that people will just rely on, lawyers will rely on. And so my hunch is that maybe not legally, but certainly kind of like ethically and principally, Westlaw should be taking precautions that everything that goes up under its banner is right. And if it's generated, then it's double and triple checked to make sure that it's correct.
But I'd hasten to add that, to the best of my knowledge, Westlaw does not rely on ChatGPT. It was a purely hypothetical version. But it makes me wonder whether anyone such as a lawyer who uses ChatGPT would be duty-bound to put a disclaimer at the top of whatever they write, saying, this is not my own work, this is ChatGPT, so be it on your head, end user, to verify because of the drug-riddled capacity of ChatGPT to make its mind up about that.
I wonder if you're right.
If I may, from ChatGPT, this could go on forever. There's going to be a lot of response to this, I'm sure. But you referred, when you sent me an email a week or so ago, you referred to the use of technology and what you referred to as tech-native courts. It's a term I hadn't heard before, but I'm sort of kind of guessing what you do mean by that. Where's your thinking heading on that? Are we heading towards tech native courts, and what do you have in mind with those?
It's not an academic term or a term that it's more a term I was just loosely using to describe. I think we're maybe in that conversation, I think we were talking about potential ways in which technology could improve access to justice. Sure. And so I think when I said tech native courts, I was thinking that there are, I don't know if we are necessarily headed towards tech native courts in a hurry. And I think, you know, you and I have talked about this before, and I know you've had many other conversations about technologies in the courts. I think courts are slow moving and often structurally resistant, often with good reason, to using newfangled technology. And I guess when I was thinking about tech native courts, I was thinking about some of the ways in which in the future you could use algorithms or potentially more sophisticated machine learning systems, maybe not ChatGPT, maybe other ones, to make the system fairer, potentially make the system more efficient, and at the least give better aids to judges and lawyers. And so when I talk about tech native courts, I'm certainly not kind of pining for a world where we don't have courts or judges, and that kind of things are just determined on the papers by an algorithm, which is, you know, I have read articles by people who like that vision and want to get us there. And I think that's a bit too radical for me. But what I really like the sense of is the question of how we can use technology to try to make courts better. And I think there's, even in the last few years, there's been some kind of pretty interesting examples around the world. And I think even when those examples go badly, and we could talk maybe about some of the use of AI in the American courts, where there's a quite a well, quite a, fa- it's a few years old now, but quite a famous expose by ProPublica against the Compass software that I was talking about earlier, which is a reasonably simple algorithm. And it found that the Compass algorithm was had serious racial biases. And that's a scary thought, because Compass is very widely deployed throughout the US, and it's used in many, many US states. But I think even in those examples where you might look at that and say, well, look, that court looks a little bit more tech native, but maybe for the worse, given it's using the software that we understand to be ridden with racial biases. But I think there's been some subsequent studies of better algorithms where, in fact, the opposite is true, and that algorithms sometimes, or over the kind of longitudinal study of this paper I have in mind, which focused on New York courts, algorithms were had displayed less of a racial bias than human judges. Mm-hmm. And so they basically took a large kind of data set of cases, and they fed some of that underlying information, which judges were looking at when making their decision, is essentially an estimate of recidivism risk. And the algorithm came out with much less of a racial bias than human judges. And I guess just to circle back, that's an example where what we have to be kind of mindful, and we do have to be mindful of the problems, particularly the opaque nature of these algorithms. Often we don't know exactly how they work, and that's a tough pill to swallow in the world of criminal justice, where we're expecting explanations. We want to understand these systems. But on the other hand, we also know that humans are pretty flawed themselves. We know that the courts, as they stand, have plenty of structural biases of their own, including obviously racial biases. It's obviously not just an American phenomenon. It's not just a New Zealand phenomenon. That's a human phenomenon. And as I read somewhere, I can't remember where, but it's a lot easier to reprogram an algorithm than reprogram a human judge. And not to say we should do away with human judges, but that is to say that we've got enormous room to make our systems fairer. And to the extent we can develop technological tools to help judges make decisions that are more equitable, I think we owe it in the kind of law and technology community to explore those. And my hope in the future is that we do get more technologically savvy with those questions, while acknowledging some of the problems that are very real and very problematic, but that there's also potential for massive improvement. And hopefully then we can take some of those and use them in the courts to make for a better system.
That could almost be a point at which to end, because it's an optimistic note, but I do have a couple of quick questions I'd like to ask you, Matt, before we do finish. Picking up on your comments just a minute or so ago on these tech-native courts, it reminds me of the rhetorical question raised by Dr. Richard Susskind, of whom you may have heard, who's been an advisor to the courts in the UK, where he raises the question several times as to whether the courts are a location or a service.
Yes.
Do you have a view of that?
I believe they're a service. I mean, I really like Richard Susskind's work. I'm inclined, I guess, as someone who is optimistic about technology, hopefully not naively optimistic. I'd like to think that I have a keen eye on some of the many kind of problems and risks that technology offers. But like Susskind, I'm optimistic, particularly if you about the use of technology in courts, particularly if you reframe from thinking about courts in the way that he describes in that quote. I think it's a good idea.
Thank you. And a final, this is going to take you back to the more jurisprudential issues, because it's a question that also comes up in our network conversations in the ODR group. It's an underlying legal ethical question, which you referred to in your opening comments, because you can't avoid the philosophical questions. An underlying issue, both in standard human law and the stuff you're dealing with, which is trust. How do we manage our abiding need to be able to trust the systems we're working with when it's beyond the comprehension of most of the people who are dealing with it and who are dealt with by it? And trust we can't do away with our need for trust, can we?
No, we can't. But that statement that you just made, I would say that equally applies to, or maybe not equally applies, but that also applies to the legal system and the criminal justice system that we have right now. And the people who interact with it predominantly do not understand how it works and why it is the way it is. And a lot of the things that we're used to as lawyers are not normal. They're not standard and they're not part of the everyday person's experience. And so I think we have a trust problem with our legal system today. I think we specifically have a trust problem with the criminal justice system. But separately to that, we definitely have a trust problem with incorporating technology, including things like like ChatGPT and the various problems with that, that any kind of technology, it is a trust exercise to some extent. And that's why I think more research in this space, more discussions like the one that we're having, I think these are all productive, because I think the only way we kind of get these systems on track, both the AI systems and some of the legal systems, and steer them in the direction that we want, it is part of a kind of broad collaborative enterprise with buy-in ideally from a large segment of society. And so, yeah, that is a challenge. And I think it's something that is an ongoing thing to think about for anyone like me, like you, who's in this space.
Thank you. And probably on that, we should wind up and I should let you have the rest of your evening or the rest of my morning. But what I would like to do, Matt, and I'll do this by email later, is to put you in contact with this year's annual ODR forum, which can be accessed online as well, because I mean, whether you're able to get to Montreal in a couple of weeks' time, in fact, which I know I won't. But I'll send you the information and the link to that, because you might be interested, because the issues you are dealing with are at the heart of what many of my colleagues are dealing with. So I'd love you to be in contact with some of those colleagues and they with you. But let's wind up.
Thanks,
thank you so much for your time. It's really good to have a chat with you again after nearly 2 years away from it. So all the best for your residence year for your doctorate. Well, it's a JSD, isn't it? Not a PhD. Yeah.
Yes, so, right.
And I look forward to keeping in contact with how that goes. Stay in line online for a second while I end this recording. And thanks and go well. And my regards also to Jess. Take care. Dear.
Thank you, Ian. It was great to chat.
This podcast has been brought to you by iCoder, the International Council for Online Dispute Resolution. To learn more about iCoder or to become a supporting member, please visit our website at icodr.org.